Good afternoon. This is Michael Stone. The show is Conversations. It is 1 o'clock, and you're listening to KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City, in Truckee 105.1, translator K286 AN. This is Conversations. I have a wonderful guest today, and he's been an explorer, an adventurer, and can tell you a lot about the state of the climate in the world. So stay tuned for Will Steger coming up next. Also want to thank the BNC, True Value Home and Garden Center, Lumberyard, Home Improvement Center and Nursery, serving professional builders and giving do-it-yourselfers technical support in the Fowler Center, Nevada City Highway, Grass Valley. Open 7 days a week. Also Haynes Ely, Grass Valley dermatologist who loves the blues. His number is 477-SKIN. So thank you so much for your support. Community calendar today, just to let you know, Stardust Cowboys perform Bob Wills style Western Swing, Cowboy Tunes at St. Joseph's Cultural Center in Grass Valley, 8 o'clock, and that is Saturday. And Friends of Nevada County Library present the 10th Annual Gold Rush Book Fair on Saturday in Main Street Building in Nevada County Fairgrounds. There'll be over 40 rare and out-of-print booksellers and book appraisal by PBA Galleries of San Francisco. All proceeds go to local libraries. Nevada County Land Trust presents Birding at the Burton Homestead and Don Ravines on Saturday, 7:30 to 11:30, a benefit for the Land Trust. More information, nevadacountylandtrust.org. Let's see, what else is here? Chief Crazy Horse this week, Tuesday, Soul Bridge, Thursday, David Starfire, Friday, Cousin Cricket, Loose Change, Saturday, Urban Coyotes, Nevada County Regulators, Sunday, Dying Breed at noon. And the League of Women Voters of Western Nevada County presented Second Candidate Forum Tuesday, May 11th, 7 p.m. It will feature candidates for the Officer Assessor and Tax Collector and takes place at the Community Room at the Office of Superintendent and Schools. And that's it for today's community calendar. Well, I'm very excited about my guest today. Will Steger has been an eyewitness to the ongoing catastrophic consequences of global warming. He's a formidable voice calling for understanding and the preservation of the Arctic and the Earth. Will is best known for his legendary polar explorations. He's traveled tens of thousands of miles by kayak and dog sled over 45 years, leading teams on some of the most significant polar expeditions in history. He's also started a foundation, the Will Steger Foundation, to foster leadership and international cooperation through environmental education and policy. Will, welcome to Conversations.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. I just finished your book, actually, this morning, and the adventure left me in chills.
Yep.
It's the book I was particularly talking about. I think you have four books, but the one I was reading was Crossing Antarctica. Yep. And I'd like to hear a little bit about that trip, but I'd also like to contrast it. This trip that I was reading about was 1989, is that when it was?
Yeah, 89, 90, yep.
89 to 90, 7 months crossing that. But since it's only been a little over a year since the Larsen B shelf, which you traveled across, started to disintegrate, I'd like to take a look at that. But let's start back at the beginning. Were you always an adventurer? Some of the things you've done I wouldn't even consider doing, but they're amazing journeys. Did you start out this way?
Yes, I did. You know, I was raised in Minneapolis in Minnesota, so I think that's probably Northern European heritage, too, the fondness of the cold. But I really have to give my parents credit, because my dad came back from World War II and raised a big family of 9 kids and had his own business. So he was an entrepreneurial person, and we were 9 of us were raised that way. We were given pretty much total freedom as young kids, you know, as long as we had a certain grade point average and stayed out of trouble with the law. And if we wanted to do something, we had to pay for it ourselves. So that I thought was pretty good rules. And they had never camped out a day in their life, you know, except for the war for my dad, so it didn't come from there. But I was given the freedom as a kid to pursue my dreams, and most of my peers as a young kid, I think most young children have this adventurous spirit. I think it's natural. I think it gets snuffed out as they, you know, if they grow up and conform. But so I was not, you know, a normal kid that way. I had the adventurous spirit. I was actually in my first big influence was reading the book Adventures of Huck Finn. That was my first book in third grade, and that really fascinated me. The river and floating down the raft and meeting the people. And so I ended up, when I was 12 years old, I bought an old wooden boat and motor and fixed it up and traded it in, saved more money and traded it in when I was 13. And then two trade-ins later, when I was 15, I had a decent boat. And so I launched that when the school got out with my older brother, who was 17. We went from Minneapolis down to New Orleans. And then we hung out in the city until school bells rang. And then we drove the boat back up the river. And that was actually my first and last motorized venture. And then I started climbing again in Minnesota back in 1960. There, you know, no one climbed at all. You couldn't find any hardware or gear. So I checked a book out of the Minneapolis Library about Mountaineering Freedom of the Hills. It's actually still a popular book, I think, that's out there. And learned my knots and skills from that. And then bought a hemp rope in a hardware store and started doing top rope climbing. And once I got my car license, that gave me access then to the mountains out west, and I got in with better climbers and better equipment. And then at the same time, I started exploring when I was 18, the Arctic regions in long kayak expeditions. My first trip north was 18 years old, 1963, and we had a collapsible full boat, me and a friend of mine, and we sent it up to Juneau, hitchhiked up to Prince Rupert and British Columbia and took the ferry to Juneau. And then from there we paddled up the Inside Passage and then made the portage over the mountains and got into the headwaters of the Yukon and then paddled down the Yukon River. And that expedition really had a big effect on me. And next year I went on to paddle another 3,000-mile route to the Arctic Ocean. And that influenced me to buy wilderness property when I was a young kid. At 19, I bought land, two lakes from the nearest road, about 3 miles away from the road, and built a cabin. I'm still living. I'm sitting in the cabin right now doing the interview. So I did. So I also had a vocation of education. I was fairly lucky kid. I had good vision of what I wanted to do. I wanted to venture. Saw myself as an educator, and I had a real deep concern for the environment, for the innocence of life, and preservation. So. And I kind of followed both lines all the way through. And I saw a need to get my college degrees before I left to the wilderness. So I got a degree in geology, biology with a teaching certificate. And then I taught for 3 years while I got my master's in education. But when I was 25, I had my credentials basically behind me. And that's when I left for the wilderness north of Ely, Minnesota. And to make a living there, I started my own school. Winter school using dog sleds and skis as a way of getting people into the wilderness. And the dogs then led me to far expeditions to the far north. And, but you know, all through high school, college, my teaching era, I did 13 years of expeditions there. So when I moved up, when I started dog sledding, you know, it wasn't a new thing for me, but I always had this call of the wild to the north. And I've been following through with that ever since. And ironically enough, you know, the scientists in the 90s, early 90s, said that the first signs of global warming would be in the polar regions. And since these areas are virtually unpeopled, very few people have seen the changes, but I've seen the before and also the after. And so I've become an eyewitness for both poles and a unique perspective, I think. And I see the reality of what's happening.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, I'd love for you to share the kind of daily routines. I know it took you 3 years to plan this crossing Antarctica trip. Amazing planning, but then 7 months out there. And, you know, I'd like you to share with people just a little bit about that trip, you know, who went on it and the dogs and how you got there and the amazing amount of tons of food and things that you took with you. Can you just share a little bit about that trip, and then maybe as you contrast it to what you see happening today up there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the expedition, that was my, of all the expeditions I've done in my life, that's really by far the greatest one I've ever been on. And it was a great adventure, but it really had a much more deeper purpose than just the adventure. 3 years before the expedition, 1986, I led the first unsupported expedition to the North Pole with 50 dogs, 5 dog teams, and 8 people. And in the Arctic Ocean, you know, massive moving ice, jumbled ice, and 200 miles out on land, I met the only person, other person, you know, size of the United States and Mexico that was traveling alone. He did actually the first solo trip, a Frenchman by the name of Jean-Louis Etienne, French physician. And we literally ran into each other 200 miles out on the ice. I mean, it was just like a Stanley Livingston coincidence. And that evening, I met in his tent, and I was unsupported, so I couldn't accept his tea, but I brought a map along, and I planned to cross Antarctica the long route, and that's what John Lee was planning. But in 86, we also knew that the treaty is, the Antarctica is protected by a very unique treaty called the Antarctic Treaty that was signed in 1960 during the height of the Cold War, actually, after the International Geophysical Year, a two-year period where all the nations for the first time ever cooperate around science. And essentially Antarctica was set aside for science only, no nuclear, no war, total international cooperation. All bases are, you know, always open for inspections or whatever.
There's also no oil or mineral rights, right, in that treaty?
The problem in 1960 is that they didn't consider the mineral rights. And so there was no mineral rights. And right before I met John Lee, the Antarctic Treaty Nations met, and behind closed doors, they drew up a formal document called the Wellington Convention that was going to open up Antarctica for mineral exploitation, because the treaty was up for review in 1990, and the treaty nations really wanted to push that and get the minerals going. And when John Lee and I met, you know, we were probably some of the only, you know, average civilians that knew what was going on there, since that was our personal interest. And we decided at that point to cross Antarctica, to make a long crossing and to bring world attention to that important review of the treaty. So we really worked behind the scenes. And that eventually, you know, 1991, the treaty was signed, and the minerals were, Antarctica was basically preserved. And but I think it was sometimes we all felt that this expedition was a piece of history, and perhaps this was something that was really behind it that gave us the fortune to have, you know, been able to do it and pulled it off. But the expedition itself was incredible, because it was the longest possible route, 3,700 miles ocean to ocean. Well, actually, we started outside of the Antarctic Circle, went all the way to the pole, and then ended outside of the other side of the Antarctic Circle. I think it was the longest polar expedition in history. But again, Antarctica is a high continent and very cold, so we had to leave in order to get across there in midwinter of the first winter, in order to get off before the second winter set in. So we had a very long, long expedition. We had trained in Greenland. We had crossed Greenland, the longest unsupported trip actually in history by dog team, 1,400 miles south-north the year before. That was a training for many reasons. One, we didn't know, nobody knew how dogs would, you know, survive at 10,000 feet for an extended period of time. And we ran the dogs at high elevation there for 60 days. But dogs did okay. We kind of figured that we'd lose about 25% of our mileage at the high elevation, which turned out to be correct. And then on that expedition, we worked out our diet and our whole systems. That long training expedition was essential. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to cross, or we probably wouldn't have survived without that training. But then the actual expedition itself, the first 30 days were pretty easy going, because we were on the Larsen A and B ice shelf. It took us 30 days to cross these ice shelves. And as you mentioned, these ice shelves are gone, unfortunately. And we were at, the ice shelves are right at almost sea level, 100 feet above.
Well, just talk a little bit about the impact of them going. Most people, it's just some ice up there, but it's far more important than that. Can you share a little bit about the importance of them?
Yeah, let me step back and then talk about the ice shelves for a second. Maybe a little bit about geography of Antarctica before I go on an adventure. Antarctica is divided geographically into two areas. The eastern Antarctica is a huge part of the continent, almost 3,000 miles across, and the average is over 10,000 feet elevation. The eastern Antarctica, because of its massive height in that, creates its own weather system. And for the most part, the higher elevations have not changed yet because of global warming. But western Antarctica, which is a little bit smaller, about 1,000 miles across, but it's 9,000 feet high at the highest. Western Antarctica is another story of a deep concern for the scientists, because all around western Antarctica are these features called ice shelves. And ice shelves are formed when the actual ice cap, the ice flows down to the ocean, you know, and then that ice flows basically out over the ocean. There's a Ross ice shelf is the size of France. 1,000 feet thick of ice and thousands of feet of water underneath it. Well, that ice has flowed out over the ocean, and what these ice shelves do is they buttress against western Antarctica, and they essentially keep all this ice that's coming down at a steep angle in place. It's almost like if you took a wine bottle with a cork and you turn it upside down. Well, the wine's not going to go anywhere because the cork's there, but if you pull the cork out, the wine goes down. And this is what's happening now in Antarctica and western Antarctica. These ice shelves, starting in the northernmost tip, which is the Larsen A and B, have already gone. There's some others on the west side there that Wilkins disintegrated last year. And since these ice shelves are at low elevation, right on sea level basically, they're really prone to any type of change in climate. You know, yeah, that could be a warming of the temperature or either speeding up of the ocean currents or a warming of the ocean or a speeding up and a warming of the currents together. And, 10 years ago when the Larsen B disintegrated, scientists didn't think that ice shelves that size could disintegrate. They know a little better now. So we have a very serious situation here because if the Larsen, for example, the Ross ice shelf, which is still stable, but if that disintegrated, we'd see a rapid rise in the sea level. I mean, rapid rise, like, you know, decades. And this has happened in past geological history, where they dug down beneath they drilled below the Ross ice shelf into the mud to get an idea of the history of the climate of several millions back, and they saw that the Ross at certain times suddenly went and just suddenly disappeared, and that coincides with rapid sea level rise, which would be catastrophic to our civilization. So, but you know, if the Larsen A and B, as I mentioned, took us 3 days across, that's foot after foot, storms, good weather, all the camps, and you know, all the experience, and you get to know an area intimately that way, and then suddenly 10 years later, you know, you're reading in the ninth page of the Minneapolis Tribune, Larsen B ice shelf disintegrates. It really leaves an impression with you of the massive size, and most people don't even know what it is. They've never heard of it, probably, but they have no concept of the seriousness of what's going on.
Yeah, you couldn't cross it at this point, could you?
No, it's open water.
Yeah.
It's, in fact, our route that we did, you couldn't cross A and B because it's gone. But you know, the rest of the route, the other 300 miles, would still be brutal conditions. I mean, you're not looking at, you know, overnight temperatures rising, you know, above freezing much, but if you did the rest of the portion of the trip, if you could do it, you'd still hit some very, very difficult weather and storms.
Now, you had temperatures as low as minus 30 and minus 40 with huge minus 200 with wind chill factor. Hey, talk a little bit about just the whole process of making this kind of trip and how the six of you worked together and yep. What were some of the issues that you encountered as you were crossing?
Yep. I generally, in the last 20-25 years, I've traveled with teams of six people and 30 dogs, which gives you three dog teams of 10 each. And with six people, then each dog team is, we call it a unit. It would be on that sled would be the dog food for those 10 dogs, and then food and supplies and gear for two people. So with six it would empower, and especially if you're doing science and photography, you need, you know, someone's usually occupied on that, but you have still five other people to fill in whenever you need it. It's a very safe combination of people to work with. And in Antarctica was international. We had six people from six countries, from France, Great Britain, China, Japan, Russia, and myself in the USA. I usually, the last 25 years, been traveling, mainly in international teams. And the international teams are great because, first of all, the learning experiences are great because you get to learn from other cultures. And I find a team to be more cool, you know, work more coherently, an international team. When you get, let's say, six Americans together, you have a tendency of getting into some problems with, you know, opinions and politics and whatever. But when you're in an international group, and when English is always our common language, but various people cannot, you know, we talk in real depth in that, that seems to get, you know, international team gets you out of a lot of problems that we do get into when we're in the same culture. Another part of that I find successful is I prefer more of a mature team. Our average age was 40 years old on that team, and that's a perfect average right there. Too young, and it doesn't quite work out all the time, especially with six people. You get a lot of competition with younger, especially younger men. And that's a generalization, because there's a lot of really great men out there that on expeditions in their 20s, but there is a tendency there as people mature and become more, you know, settled in themselves, to be more cooperative as a group. So we had the international team of six, and we trained. Our normal travel day would be a 10-hour travel day with a half-an-hour break for lunch.
And you were going like 20 to 25 miles in a day.
Yeah, we would average 20, you know, once we got on the plateau, which was for 4 months, we were averaging around 23, 24. We would travel, we worked it out so we would travel a 10-hour day and then 10 straight days, one day off, and then 10 more days, one day off. We found that to be perfect because the rest day was enough to give the dogs and the people, you know, enough time to rest up. So you could almost travel indefinitely on that schedule. And it was a tough schedule, but you could still survive and travel. If you did 11 days, we found out you'd burn out. And if you burn out, it's not just you, it's always the energy of the dogs. If you burn the dogs out, you burn the candle here at both ends. Because if you burn out, then you've got to rest them longer. And then you're just a vicious cycle. And
well, Will, say something about the physicalness of it. I'm not, you know, I had this image of just riding on the back of the dog sled across, you know, even though it was cold. But you were on skis, and at many times you were running for most of the thing, running behind the dog sled. I've run marathons before, and I couldn't walk for a week afterwards.
Yeah. Well, you have to be in good conditioning. We generally ski. In rough conditions, we're running. We ski, you know, that 23 miles a day. We are not, though, and in the running of 23 miles a day, we're running at a little slower pace than you would do a marathon, but still, it's a marathon. And but on skis, they're a little easier, but depends on the conditions. If you have strong winds against you, it's really brutal. But if you've got clear weather and it's not blowing too hard, or the wind's in a favorable direction, the time passes a little bit better. You know, I mentioned we took us 30 days to cross the Larsen A and B. Then once we got up on the Antarctic Peninsula to higher elevation in the mountains, we had storms that blew for almost 60 straight days. And these were, no one had ever traveled in the winter before, and we found out why. But logistics are very important on this trip. You play a strategy in your logistics, and if you're looking, your strategy is wrong, you know, you won't do the trip, or most likely you won't survive. So what we, and doing this long of a trip, you cannot do it unsupported. You have to have the catches. You have to have some sort of a resupply, and that's very complicated. So what we did by airplane the summer before, we laid out food caches about every 200 or 300 miles, so all the way to the pole for the first 2,000 miles. So on paper it looked like this is going to be an easy trip. We just go travel every 200 or 300 miles, pick up the next food, and keep on going. But the problem was we didn't know about these storms. This was before the GPS. And we think the plane probably landed, put our ca- Abu Dhabi and a couple different wrong places. But we ended up losing three of the caches. Very fortunately, we lost every other one, or else we wouldn't have survived. The storms were so bad, we didn't let on to the outside world of what was going on, because the worst thing you do is have your sponsors and everybody panicking and wanting to pull you off. And there was no way anybody could rescue us, so you know, we just kind of didn't let on to what was going on. And it was very serious. We were forced to travel in the worst conditions imaginable. We had to travel to survive. And the Scott expedition, where his men died on the way back to the pole, the race to the pole between him and Amundsen, Scott, the Englishman, his team of five all perished on the way back, really gave us a lot of empathy for them, because we were traveling in the same situations, and we'd be on severe rations and almost impossible conditions. And there's always one person in the team that had the strength to do the cheerleading in the morning, and you know, we got going again. And so we survived that after 30, 60 days. And then after that, then we got up to the higher elevation, where from there on we had 4 months of pretty good weather. It was cold, but high elevation, but clear. We were way behind schedule, but we were able to get into that 10-day on, one-day off routine for 4 months and picked up our distances. And we managed to come, the second winter set in when we were at 11,000 feet. You know, this is the coldest place on Earth. Temperature was dropping 1 degree centigrade a day, and it was down to 60 below. And so it was really a race to get off the continent. The sun was setting, the darkness was coming. And then as we dropped in elevation, we picked up more storms again, the winter storms this time, but made it off, you know, on March 3rd.
Talk about the relationship to the dogs. They're really... What allowed you to even do it? And I think that's an important aspect of this kind of a journey.
Yeah, the dogs are everything. I mean, you rely on them for your survival. They rely on us. First of all, our relation with the dogs, it's not quite like a work animal. We raise these dogs since pups. They're a wilder breed. They're a Canadian Greenland Eskimo dog, a little bit of wolf, Yukon River dog. We took the best of the best of the northern breeds and put them together. They're a little kind of antisocial, a little bit. They can be. That's why they need a lot of love and care as pups, to give them confidence in people. Food and diet was absolutely essential. We always fed them. Science Diet was always the food. We were sponsored by them for the last 25, 30 years almost now. But so nutrition is very, very important to the young dogs. But then the training before the expedition, we put a lot of time and money into the training. In the wintertime here in Ely, we would do 6 days, take Sunday off. But the training would go 10-hour days for 6 days, just with very heavy sleds. So it's like weightlifting and building them up. So we put a lot of effort. The dogs, like I said, there's a mutual respect, something you don't often get with the animals. We have a lot of pets. You know, people have this. But actually, if you look at a pet dog, pets are actually neurotic, a dog that is, because dogs are a very social animal within their own pack, like a wolf. But if you take your average pet, they haven't been socialized in a group of dogs. They're usually a one-person, animal. Maybe there's two pets or so. But these dogs are very socialized within their own groups and their families, actually, that go way back. And so they have that socialization within themselves. But on the actual expedition, there's a dependency of them on us and us them. So there's really a mutual respect between us. And also, people ask, do they have names? Do you know your dogs? I mean, you know your dogs very well. I mean, they know you usually better than you know yourself. I mean, the dogs are masters of watching human behavior. But so we're extremely close to the dogs. And in fact, in our tents, a lot of our conversations are always around dogs. It's always safe to talk about dogs. So they are really central to everything. And they're actually kind of like the spirit of the expedition. It would be a totally different expedition wouldn't be rich at all without the dogs. I mean, if you had six people, it'd be a good human experience, and imagine being a good trip. But with the dogs, it really adds to it. And they're just so powerful. Their ideal temperatures are 30 to 40 below zero, so they're right at home in these severe conditions. They do not like warm temperatures. I mean, for them, they suffer in the summer when it gets 70 degrees. And so you have to think, kind of think opposite of a sled dog. They're made for the pulling and made for a cold. That's where they're happy. And they're not happy so much in a, you know, human-type situation where we're comfortable.
I love the opening of your book in July of 1989. I just wanted to read that for people. The stench of wet dogs, kerosene, cigarette smoke, molding cheese, and sweat-stained clothing saturated the air of the Soviet flying coffin as we closed in on Antarctica. I just, you know, that really brought me into the book. I thought, wow, how do you put something like this together? And one of my other thoughts was, what about the money? I mean, how much does a trip like this cost, and how do you raise that much money?
Yeah, this is millions of dollars. And, you know, prior to that, in the 70s and 80s, right up to right before this expedition, I was my income was like $2,000 a year. So, I mean, I lived in the wilderness, raised my own food, and I'm not a wealthy person. I didn't have any money in the bank. But, you know, I wanted to do Antarctica, so, you know, I moved to the city, put on a suit and tie, and went to Washington, New York, and meeting John Lee. I raised almost $4 million in the United States. Now, the late 80s were very good economic times because a lot of this has to do with economics. I mean, you wouldn't, and I've never raised that much money since. So the timing was correct. Also, in the late 80s, the Soviet Union was still in full power, but they were opening up to the West at that time, and that's why, well, we made diplomatic contact with them, and the Soviets became our partners. They provided us with the Aleutian era, the big super jet plane that threw us down there, and they picked us up by ship. So the Soviet Union were basically our partners on the expedition. I had a Soviet on the team. China was fully cooperating. We stayed at their base. We visited. I mean, this is before China, you know, came out of the closet here as a nation. And but everything came together. It was a golden time. I've never been able to repeat anything like that. Everything always happened at the same time and at the right time, with money and diplomatic international relations. I think it was, we all felt it was a piece of history. I mean, it was everyone totally cooperated. You can get a complicated expedition like this and you get it. One or two people that are not cooperating, that have their own agenda, the whole thing falls down or turns into a lot of work.
Well, it seemed in reading your book that everyone was cooperating except for the United States government and the NFC. You know, it was almost embarrassing to read some of the things you talked about there. You want to speak about the secrecy and the lack of support?
Yeah. The National Science Foundation, which is now, you know, this is a different era for NSF, but rightly so, NSF had a policy of no cooperation whatsoever with private expeditions, which we totally understood. They had a tourist flight to McMurdo Bay from about 200 and some people on a plane from New Zealand that flew to over McMurdo. They were going to fly over the two volcanoes there. They asked for some weather conditions from NSF, which they gave it, but the plane crashed and everyone died. This is in the 70s. I mean, this was a big lesson to the NSF, no cooperation. But we were totally self-sufficient. I mean, we understood their issues. But there was a series of private expeditions that have a tendency, used to at least, tendency of going down there and saying, well, if we get in trouble, NSF will rescue us if they have to. Well, NSF, National Science Foundation, their science is planned years in advance, and every hour of airtime is used up on their experiments. They pull off their logistical support for a search rescue or whatever. It severely hampers their science. So we totally understood where they're coming from. We had our own planes, totally self-supported. We had, like I mentioned, Soviet Union, China were just 100% on this thing. It was unbelievable. You know, it's during the Cold War, you know, we feared Russia under the atomic bombs and that, and here it is, you know, they're allies of ourselves at that time. But NSF at that time was not cooperating, and we understood where they're coming from, but we felt they kind of pushed it way over bounds of where they should have went. But, you know, that was an era that, well, by God era, and actually when I worked on the Antarctic Treaty when I came back, I had a number of scientists that I still have wonderful relations with, NSF. But it was difficult when you have a government agency, the biggest government down there, kind of wanting your demise. But, you know, we made it with, even without their help.
So things are getting better now, I take it. At least,
yeah, but you,
at least with NSF.
Yeah, with NSF, but you still can't expect support from a government. I mean, as a person that I've done expeditions all my life, you have to be self-supporting. You can't expect to go out and have a country unexpectedly bail you out, or a plan where they'll bail you out if you have trouble. And so, you know, there always is these issues in Antarctica. Although it's all the flights, the expedition that run, most of the expeditions down there are very professional, and they're actually weeded out mainly because there's only one. Adventure Network is the only network. It's a different network right now that runs the logistics for expeditions, and you have to have certain qualifications to be down there right now. So.
Right. I know that one of the important things in your doing this is to bring public awareness to not only Antarctica, but to the impact of climate change. Can you talk to us about some of the lessons that you've learned in these adventures, and some of the changes that you see and the impact on our planet?
Yeah. Let me talk about some of the changes. And I wish I could sit down with your audience for the 40-minute PowerPoint to show you the visuals that I have firsthand, but every ice shelf that I have traveled on in my career have disintegrated. That's both in Antarctica and the Arctic. In the Arctic, the Ordhund ice shelf, Isles ice shelf, Markham ice shelf disintegrated here in the last 3-4 years. The Arctic Ocean, size of the United States to Mexico. When I first started in 86, that used to be a solid ice, and now 2 years ago, we lost 50% of the sea ice on the Arctic Ocean in the summer. And we're very close now to losing the sea ice. Serious, because you're looking at an area that you have...
Well, I'm losing my connection with you here.
Oh, let me just one second here. I'll correct that.
Okay.
And one second, sorry about that, Michael.
Put you back in the cold where you're used to.
Yeah. I'm sitting in the cold corner here. That should be a little better here. Okay. Heck with a wood stove. Yeah. The Arctic Ocean, in the polar regions, you get 24-hour light, sunlight, for 5 months. So envision an area the size of Mexico and the United States receiving all that radiation for 5 months. That used to strike in the summertime ice and reflect most of that, 90% plus of that energy would reflect into outer space, which basically kept the top of the Earth cool during the summertime, which was a heat balance, because we have an excess amount of heat in the tropics. And in fact, because of the Arctic Ocean and the sea ice, that's given us a fairly mild climate here in the last 7,000 years or so. Well, that's all changing now. And in 07, the amount of ice that broke up would be, if you took all the land east of the Mississippi River in the United States, that's the amount of ice that broke up in just one season. So when that broke up, you suddenly have a real darker water surface, which starts absorbing energy. So this is a tipping point where and we're very close now. Probably within a decade, we're going to lose all the ice in the summer. It does freeze back. You know, the sun sets for 5 months in the winter. We're always going to have some cold winter, because when the sun sets there, globally or not, you know, it's cold up north, way up there. That will freeze. But then when it freezes, what broke up here, I should say this, in 2007, that area of the east of the Mississippi River, you know, that all that area, that was what was called multi-year ice. That's old ice, ice that's been around for over 10 years, up to 10 years. It's basically the breeding ice of the Arctic Ocean, the core ice. That is what broke up in 07. That was what the problem was. So you would have the ocean freeze up that next winter, and then the skeptics would come out and say, okay, where's your global warming? The ocean's froze back to the 1979 levels. Well, what froze up here is young ice. That's very thin ice. So the next summer, all that ice just instantly, you know, as soon as you get a storm, breaks up to right where it was the year before, and then it starts breaking up more of the older ice. So we're looking at is the changing of the heat balance of the globe. In the 90s, I crossed the Arctic Ocean in 95 from Russia through the pole down to Canada. That's when we started to see for the first time a lot of open water in the winter and spring. And this is accelerating over time. Essentially what's happening in the northern hemisphere with the warmer climate with global warming, we're melting a lot of the snow and ice that used to stick around for most of the season or maybe all the season. And when we melt the snow and ice, this is a thin layer of snow and ice. This is not making a sea level rise, but it's changing the reflectivity of the ground. So what's happening is we're losing that sea ice and changing that darker surface, either land or ground or water surface is turning darker. And that accelerates. That's called a positive feedback. It's a domino effect. And once you start getting more darker surfaces, it now starts absorbing, and then it melts more. And the more it melts, the more heat, and the faster the melting. It's a vicious cycle. The real dangerous thing here that concerns a lot of scientists, and I've always been concerned, and I've testified to Congress on both these issues, actually methane and the sea ice in 91, but with the absorption of this excess amount of heat, we're starting to see the permafrost in the northern regions. Now, the permafrost is permanently frozen ground. Most of that's frozen swamp. And that's 3 million square miles of permafrost. It's a huge area. I mean, it's an area of 50 times larger than the permafrost in Alaska, to get an idea of its size. But when this permafrost thaws in the summer, the organic material thaws out and starts, some of it starts decaying. And then in the decomposition, it gives off methane. You know, any of your listeners might, you know, walk in a swamp at one time or another and smell this stinky smell. That's methane. And that's typical of a swamp. It's the decaying vegetation. Well, methane is 21 times more dangerous greenhouse gas than CO2. So we're at a place here, if we don't act quickly, that this methane may start releasing, and then the climate could go out of control. Right now, we are causing the forcing, or we're causing the warming, because we're putting, burning of fossil fuels, we're adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. 75% of the global warming is coming from CO2 from our fossil fuels. CO2 is a heat-trapping gas. It's just like putting a sweater on your body, but it's an invisible gas that traps heat on the Earth. The more CO2 you put into the air, the warmer the Earth gets. And that's what's causing the warming, and that in turn is causing the melting of the ice, which changes the reflectivity. We have the breakups of the ice shelves. And I also should add that in Greenland, I crossed Greenland in the summer 2008. In Greenland now, the thawing levels, the summer thaws, are going up to like 8,000 feet. And the thawing levels in an average used to be about 1,000 feet. So you're getting a lot of water on that ice cap. The ice cap itself now is still stable, but the southern parts of Greenland on the coastline, some of these glaciers, if you can believe this, are moving about 15 miles a year. You know, glaciers move meters a year. These are moving miles a year.
Wow.
And that's from the ice, the water. It's equivalent flow of, you know, the amount of water coming off is equivalent to the water that goes out of the Amazon. But it goes down, that water goes in the streams, and then it drops through the ice, through crevasses and holes, all the way down, sometimes it goes down a mile. And then it flows out at the bottom of the glacier, bottom of the ice cap, and that lubricates the glacier, the ice caps. And that's where you get the surging. And that's where we're starting to see a sea level rise right now. But, you know, we control right now. We have less than 10 years on this. But we have control on this climate, because if we can start reducing our CO2 quickly, we can avoid the worst of the catastrophe. But if we continue business as usual as we're doing now, in a very short time, this whole thing is going to get out of hand. And the real golden plus to this, all this, as I see it, is the solutions are economic. People would not make habit changes in their lives that much for the sake of the polar bear. You know, we're all concerned about getting the food on the table and feeding the kids and paying our taxes and that. The bears are one thing, and saving the world is another thing too, but there's more important things at home. But you know, we ironically have three major crises at the same time, all depending on, it all swings around our addiction to fossil fuels. We have an obvious climate crisis. We also have the economic recession, a serious recession for America, because we don't have, we don't have, uh, we lost most of our manufacturing base, or a large portion of it. In usual recessions, you know, manufacturing picks up, you know, economy goes well. You know, it's going to be China's manufacturing that's going to pick up here.
We've also given up our farming communities to agribusiness and GMOs and that kind of thing,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and the solutions
there. Which makes
us
very vulnerable.
Yeah, our solutions there, then, are, you know, the new clean energy economy. Then the third crisis, of course, it's a very obvious one, is our dependence on foreign oil. And 95% of our oil comes from foreign governments. We spend $1 billion a day, we all do, when we heat our homes and throw our gas. $1 billion a day goes to foreign oil. A lot of that's Persian Gulf, Venezuela, you know, our great friends over there. And also coal. Coal is really the culprit of the global warming. And coal, you know, it goes to major corporations. I mean, Minnesota does not have coal or fossil fuels. We spend $1 billion itself on energy here. It goes outside the state. And so the solutions are two things. New clean sources of energy, and this be, you know, the obvious one that people think of immediately is wind. The United States gets less than 4% of its wind now from energy. The wind industry, I believe, employs more people now than the coal industry. You know, we've been fed this line of baloney for the last 20 years that we've changed the economy over the worst thing for the economy, and that's not true at all. Solar industries, the price of solar is drastically going to drop within 5 years. And even though China will probably manufacture most of these solar panels, the installation and management of these panels is a huge industry in the United States. Geothermal. Minnesota, a lot of houses are starting to do geothermal, where you're taking heat out of the ground. And that industry is all local. You know, all the, you don't go to China and bring Chinese plumbers over here to put on your geothermal. Most of the parts are American made. So, and then the second part of this equation of fuels is energy, conservation of energy. You know, better buildings, windows, better lighting, and so forth. And most of that's American enterprise. And what we're looking at here is making the transition away from oil. It's going to be a 20-year transition. Now is a critical time because oil, the fossil fuel industries, and this is all on the web. I'm not a radical here, but it's all on the web. They spend about $100 million a year in disinformation.
I was wanting you to talk about that because, you know, when I go to Copenhagen or to just back from Bolivia to climate change conferences, there's never any question about the science. But here they have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in disinformation and confusion. And people think, well, it's actually because of sunspots or this is a natural thing that's happening. There's nothing we can do about it. How would you suggest people address people that have that belief, especially people who watch Fox News?
Well, first of all, you have to look at, they're using the same strategy and some of the same people that they did on the tobacco industries in the 60s and 70s, that campaign. And basically what they did is they would have a doctor smoking saying it's fine with health or some innuendo like that. They're not out to disprove global warming or cigarettes. They just want to keep the confusion. And it's just confusing. Keep the confusion. And when you have $100 million a year to do that, you're in your own networks and you own presidents, you can do a pretty good job at that. And fear is another thing that they do, you know, the fear of changing the economy and so forth. First of all, in talking about, how do you talk to a skeptic? First of all, we have to realize that, I wish I could show you one graph here, but the levels of carbon dioxide have risen so much in the last 100 years. It is 100% higher than it. You know, it's this graph. It is our CO2. Well, put it this way. Let me just take a minute to explain this. 2 billion years ago, our Earth had no life, and it was a very hot planet, and we had a lot of carbon dioxide in the air. Gradually, through the evolution of the oceans, life and plant life evolved, and then during hundreds of millions of years, we had lush jungles, the dinosaur era, all around there, huge jungles and forests. And these forests, very slowly, over hundreds of millions of years, took this carbon out of the atmosphere and put put it into their plant bodies, and then these plant bodies were laid down in massive coal and petroleum deposits over 100 million years. In 100 years or less, in a geological microsecond, we've blown this carbon back into the atmosphere, and that's what's heating the globe. And the variations, because climate is always variable. And I can see people's confusion that, okay, it's snowing. Where is your global warming? Well, if you don't see clearly the amount of CO2 and understand that part of it, that this is way beyond any climate variation. I mean, sunspot activity, all this stuff, over a period of time will, 10,000 years will give you an ice age or a warming period, but in 100 years, you won't see this rise. And it's very hard to argue with people because there are several things. The worst part of it is it's gone political. So it's right or left, and it's very hard because you get yourself into political discussions, which you can't win. And there's other issues. Like I say, people are afraid to change. They're thinking that we want people to go back to the cave and, and live under candlelight, where we're looking at, hey, this is going to be a really high quality of life that we're talking about, where we're not addicted to fossil fuels, where we're hiring our own people. I mean, I went to Sweden to look at their biomass last fall, and they took this their addiction seriously many years ago, and they get about 50% of their energy from biomass from their forest and waste product, septic sewer plants and so forth, and they have no recession. Their forest industry, the countryside with forests, incredible forests, good wildlife, lots of small industries of wood manufacturing, windows, furniture and so forth, no unemployment, and that's because 50% of their energy comes from their own economy. And we always need energy, so their economy is 50% at least is there, and that's what we're talking about here in America. It's about jobs, and I was a moderate Republican at one time because of business and entrepreneurial. That's the way my family was, and that's what we were raised to be small business people, entrepreneurial. That's what an expedition's about. That's American dream, and I have a hard time with the present politics of the Republican Party. I think they've lost most of the business people. But I have a hard time mainly because they're the party of business, and we need them on board on this. We can't do this without Republicans, but we need them to see this opportunity here for business that they're making huge amounts of money. If my father's generation that came back from the war was alive today, they would see all sorts of opportunities. They'd be all over this, instead of falling victim here to this propaganda by the oil companies.
Well, Will, I've got about 1 minute left, and I'd like you to just wrap it up with,
yep.
What can the individual do? Sometimes it seems so overwhelming,
yep. Yep.
Can you bring it down yep. home for us?
Yeah, let me do it in 1 minute. First of all, there is a lot of hope here. This is definitely American enterprise, and the whole world is waiting for us to take leadership on this. So there's great hope, but we can do probably two things within our personal habits. I mean, you can go on the web and educate yourself. I mean, I don't have to give you 10 things to do, but we should be working towards, reducing our carbon footprint, which is conservation, which is going to save us money. And as oil prices go higher, we're going to be paying for the spill in the Gulf. So we're going to see oil go up permanently here soon. And so we're looking at, personally saving money, not just conservation for the environment. But regardless of what we do, good acts by ourselves, we can't change the world. So we have to act collectively, to act politically in particular. And I would say to be the important thing here politically is to be tolerant of other views, because coming in fighting is not going to get anywhere. That's where we're stuck right now in the impasse. But we really have to work collectively on this issue, cooperatively if we can. But politically, getting your representatives on board, educating them, encouraging them, and if they're not going your way, get together and vote them out. There's totally irresponsible. helpful for the younger generation not to be on board on this.
Absolutely. Will, I'm going to have to wrap it up, but Will Steger, I just want to thank you for your tireless efforts for many decades, and congratulations on winning the National Geographic Adventure Lifetime Award, as well as many other awards. If people want to know more, you can either go to the Will Steger, WILLSTEGER, foundation.org, or www.willsteger.com. And, Will, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay, thanks, Ed.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Amazing adventure. Fabulous to have somebody like that on with that kind of experience. I want you to know that next week is the membership drive special, and I have a very special guest, actually two of them. Rupert Sheldrake. Have you heard of morphogenic fields, morphogenic resonance? Well, tune in. He's one of the world's most innovative and controversial biologists and writers, best known for his theory of morphic fields and morphic resonance, which leads to a vision of developing universe with its own inherent memory. He's the author of many books, including Morphic Resonance. And also in the second hour, will be from 12 to 2, in the second hour I'll have Father Miguel Descoto Brockman, who's a Nicaraguan diplomat, politician, and Catholic priest. He was the president of the United Nations General Assembly from September 2009. And I have to tell you, this is one of my favorite interviews of all time. I don't know about when you listen to it, but I was moved to tears through the entire interview. So stay tuned next week. We'll have a special membership drive show. Rupert Sheldrake and Father Descoto Brockman and you. So please think about pledging and being a member, and I look forward to being on the show with you next week. Thank you so much.